I like tomatoes. In fact, I ran into a Westminsterite in the supermarket not too long ago who happened to notice the solid 2 pounds of little cherry tomatoes I had perched atop the other groceries in my cart. And as many of you know, I became Farmer Ellen this summer with a crop of 8 well-loved cherry tomato plants in my garden. In fact, I like tomatoes so much, I have them with my lunch almost every day. You may be wondering why I'm talking about tomatoes in a sermon on attention and stewardship. In this month of attention, I've been paying closer attention to everything. And at the beginning of every meal, I do what Buddhist teacher Pema Chodron has called the three-bite practice. First bite, offer the food in your mind to a teacher, a guide, or someone who has offered you wisdom. Then, second bite, imagine offering the food to someone who has been kind to you recently. And finally, third bite, offer the food metaphorically to someone or some group that is suffering. But here's the thing. I caught myself one day idly thinking that I didn't want to do the three-bite practice with the tomatoes. I wanted to do it with the carrots, which I also like, but not as much. I apparently wanted to keep the tomatoes for myself, for the part of the meal that's all mine that I don't have to share. Now, you may be thinking, because you are paying attention, wait, hold on. You know you're not actually sharing anything really physically, right? You know that even if you do that practice, you are still the one eating the tomatoes. You know that, right? Yes, I know. Yet there I was, resisting it anyway. My inner 3-year-old strikes again. Resisting giving something away, even if it's all in my head. But then again, I suppose that's where generosity begins, in the head, or maybe in the heart. I share this humbling story with you today, not so much because I want you to rethink your relationship with tomatoes, but as a window into part of the human condition, because maybe you too sometimes have a naysaying 3-year-old showing up at the conference table of your inner decision-making committee. Maybe for you, that's not tomatoes, but not wanting to share the TV remote. Mine, something in you says insistently. Or maybe for you, that's some inner voice telling you, I'm going to get this new smartphone, new sequined dress, new car, new power tool without entirely checking the finances totally 100% to see if it actually fits the budget or might have an impact on someone else. Or maybe for you, it's refusing to let those annoying drivers with their insistent turn signals merge into your lane because, hello, I'm trying to get somewhere too, and this is my lane. Right? However that might look for you, I think there's something worthwhile in a sermon on generosity, in giving some airtime, paying some gentle attention to the parts of us that do not always want to be generous, the parts that want to hold on to something for whatever reason. Not all of us were afforded that opportunity growing up when we were 3 or any other age. Many of us were taught to just give, whether we liked it or not. I encountered one story this week of a woman whose parents would insist that she share whether or not she felt ready. She recounts an incident as a 5-year-old when her friend's younger brother grabbed her plush stuffed Barney toy right out of her hands, and she was told to gift it to him. She already understood from her parents' perspective that holding on would make her bad. Giving it away would make her good. Recognizing the repercussions of the decision, she did the math, and reluctantly, she gave up her favorite purple dinosaur. But what a choice. Still, many of us, by the time we're adults, we frequently do this kind of thing to ourselves. We hit 3-year-old override. We metaphorically put our hands over our ears, we squeeze our eyes shut and force ourselves to do whatever we think is the right thing, because then our parents or someone will think we're good, right? We let those annoying drivers cut in front of us. We force ourselves to give someone or something something because we feel guilty. We give up control of the remote or the movie choice or the vacation decision to someone else because they want it. Although we may exude a long-suffering sigh under our breath. Not exactly a heartwarming experience for anyone. Or maybe we allow that part of us that's looking out for us to finally assert itself. We'll just do it. We'll decide. We'll spend the money. We'll go where we want. We will not let anyone into our lane ever. That can feel good for a while, but is also not terribly heartwarming. So, paying some attention to what goes on underneath the surface when it comes to being generous or not being generous. For me, I have discovered it's not just a 3-year-old sitting at my conference table. I at least have other outspoken voices in here too. And frankly, some of them have a point. Like the one that says, if I just gave everything away or let everyone around me have what they wanted, I would have nothing left. If I always give, where does that leave me? Point two. I, like many good Dutch kids, many New Englanders, and many others, was trained in the fine art of paying as little as possible for as much as you can get. Maybe this resonates with you, I don't know, but it's just good business sense, right? Point three, most people are trying to scam you anyway. Watch out, right? Apparently, my less generous self is also a little bit cynical, but sincerely protective of me. Still, it's not a very pretty picture of the world or my place in it, this worldview based on wariness, shrewdness, and skepticism. And how many of us have been conditioned under the surface to feel shrewd or wary or skeptical? And when we act on those beliefs, when we are always on the lookout for a scam, always trying to squeeze the most out of the least, what kind of life experience does that create? What impact do our beliefs about life's treasures have on our hearts? How does our relationship to our money, our time, our treasure, how does that affect how we feel about ourselves and how we feel about the world we live in? But then there's that parable about the wise woman. While it's a little radical, after all, she gave everything away, it does point, I think, to something important. It points to a very different way of seeing the world and being in the world, a way that apparently is more valuable even than the jewel this woman gave to the beggar. A way of being quite different from what most of us have been taught. This woman is not about good business sense. She is not acting on market economy principles. She does not appear to be wary about who's trying to scam what from whom. She seems to be living from some spiritual place of sufficiency, abundance, and kindness. How crazy is that? How heartwarming is that? How heartwarming would it be if any of us could do that consistently? Now, inspiring as that image may be, most of us do not live in a forest or a fairy tale. Much as we may not want to live in a world as dark as our worst fears or our greatest skepticism, we also do not live in a utopia. We have to deal with grocery bills or college bills or medical bills. We have to make wise decisions about our resources in a world that is not quite as simple as this parable. So we are left with this dilemma. What do we choose to see? Which viewpoints do we choose to listen to? How do we choose to live? How do we navigate between our spiritual ideals of who we want to be and the mundane facts of our real lives? One thing I have noticed in paying attention to all the many viewpoints that live inside my head is that some of them tend to pipe up immediately. They sound adamant. They grab me by the shoulder. They are the ones along the lines of, I can't, I don't wanna, I don't have enough, I won't have enough, or the slightly suspicious, why are you asking me anyway? Or they're the kind of thoughts that insist I give, overriding me with a heavy, you should, you must, or you have to. Either way, I've noticed what tends to drive those very first, most outspoken thoughts is some kind of fear or some kind of negativity. But then I've noticed if I sit with it long enough without moving directly to action, other thoughts begin to surface. Maybe I do have enough. Maybe this is worthwhile. Maybe I actually want to do this. Then those different viewpoints have a heart-to-heart. What's really true? What is actually too much? What are my values telling me? What do I really want? In that mix, I realize I don't have a direct line to some objective truth. I've come to the conclusion that none of the thoughts I have fully describe the whole picture. But what I have noticed is that when I reactively follow those first impulses, I'm more apt to believe a skeptical worldview. And that reactive part feels empowered just a little. But when I take a moment, on the other hand, and step back, when I experiment with kinder, more generous ideas, I learn things. Sometimes I learn, yep, that was too much. That left me exhausted or was not quite enough for the rest of that month. Other times I find I did have enough and more. And not only that, I feel good about me. I feel good about the person I was generous with. The world feels a little kinder than it did before. And so do I. Now, you may be thinking this is a stewardship sermon. When does the other shoe drop? When will she tell us what to give and how to give it? So here's the thing. I won't. And I can't. Only you can have that conversation with yourself or your family. Only you know the shape of your dreams and the realities of your obligations. Only you can discern between the voices in your head that feel true to you and the ones that may be painting an unnecessarily wary picture of your world. Only you can decide what you want to try, what you want to risk, and what it is that you hope for. I can't tell you what to give, but I can tell you what I do and why I do it. When I first started regularly attending church, I decided somewhat arbitrarily to give about $15 a week. As I've come to understand more about the many confusing and competing viewpoints that factor into my financial decision-making, I've come to appreciate the wisdom of a simple percentage guide for giving. And as I've learned more about what it actually takes to run a church, I have, over time, increased my giving in line with, over time, my increased commitment. So that now I'm giving a little over 5% of my income because I want to invest not just my time and my energy, but my money in what I most deeply and most passionately believe in, which is the values embodied in this faith, the values embodied in this place, with our calling to help others, where we nurture the children we love in dozens of different ways. This place where we believe in democracy and practice it all the time. This place where relationships we nurture among all ages can last a lifetime. Relationships that can change lives, maybe even save lives. I want to invest in this place where we're not perfect and we know it and it's okay, because we can keep coming back into covenant with each other, even if, as the poet Rumi assures us, even if we've broken our vows 1,000 times. I believe in this place where the aspirational and inspirational and material meet right on this property, where the beauty of our dreams and the cost of our heat literally intersect. Right here in this space that is holding us right now, this place whose future rests in the hands of those who care for it. I can't and I won't tell you what to give or what to do or how to live. But I do invite you to reflect. I invite you to pause, to take a step back from whatever negative, fearful, or pressured messages are inside or around you, and consider your dreams, the world you hope for, and how this place might help make it happen. Where do you want your treasure to live? Where do you want your heart to live? And what would happen if we all put our treasure where our hearts want to be? Amen.